but whipsawing strategy around policy is a really fast way to destroy capital.
Hello and welcome back to the Plugged In Podcast, a weekly news show all about the future of transportation. I'm Patrick George, Editor-in-Chief of Inside EVs.
And I'm Tim Levin, Senior Editor at Inside EVs. On this week's show, we have a very special guest joining us. Mark Royce, President of General Motors, you may have heard of it, is here to talk about EVs, batteries, China, and the new Chevy Bolt. But before that, we've got some news to cover. New, cheaper EVs are here, and Patrick got to drive one of them. We'll talk to him about his impressions. Plus, America's first extended-range EV will be a Jeep, and we've got many, not all, but many of the details about that new vehicle. How's it going, Patrick, though? What's new with you?
I'm good, Tim. We're in full fall season here in upstate New York. The leaves are turning, and I'm sick of it, honestly. I've been in foliage mode for like a month now. I've been looking at my photos of cars I take for fun and for reviews, and there's too many turning leaves in all of them, and I'm getting bored, man.
Like a really weird thing to complain about. I'm starting to realize it's always the weather with you, Patrick. It's either too hot or too cold or too much beautiful fall foliage around me. What would make you happy?
It's just performative, Tim. It's performative and annoying. It's trying too hard. Well, how are things in your life?
Good. Things are good. I went yesterday. I can't talk about it yet, but this week I went to Palo Alto to go see the new vehicle. I can call it a wheeled vehicle, maybe, from Also, which is that startup that spun out of Rivian earlier this year that's making smaller than car vehicles, which we don't officially know what they are yet. But that's coming out next week, so we could talk about it on the next episode. And it was really cool. I got to ride it, whatever it is. I'm really excited to talk more about it. It was one of the coolest products I've seen in a long time. I'll say that. Yeah.
Yeah, you showed me a little bit of that, and like we're super embargoed on it, so we can't talk about it at all. But I'm really amped to hear more, man. In the meantime, we got some other stuff coming up that we're pretty excited about in this world.
Yes, things we can talk about, news that we're actually not embargoed or early on. We're actually kind of like a week late as you hear this, which is the new Chevy Bolt, which you've probably seen. This dropped last week, just after we recorded last week's episode. So now we're excited to talk about that.
Yeah, they don't work around our schedules as much as we'd like them to, the car makers. I keep asking, and they're just not returning my emails, which is sad and unfortunate. But we've been excited about the new Chevy Bolt for a while now, and both you and I, Tim, were big fans of the old one. I think kind of everybody was in a lot of ways, and now that we've seen the specs on the new one, we're even more excited. So you want to run some of those down?
Yeah, for sure. So it's basically, for anybody who knew the old Bolt before it was discontinued, it is generally similar, but just kind of better in every way. So the new Chevy Bolt, 255 miles of range. That's up only slightly from the outgoing one. But 150 kilowatt charging, about triple the max rate before. It was like 55 kilowatts before, which was kind of pretty uninspiring, very slow if you're out there road tripping.
It was not fast charging before the Bolt.
Right. Fast would have been an overstatement.
Yeah,
10 to 80% in 26 minutes. It now has the Tesla-style NACS plug, 65 kilowatt-hour LFP battery pack. And so basically, on the inside, a lot has changed. On the outside, not so much. It looks a lot like the old Bolt EUV, just like slightly updated front and rear fascias, but the best part of it is what it costs, right? It is starting at $28,995. So basically the same price, comparable price, the old Bolt, but a lot better of a vehicle than the old Bolt. What do you think of it? This was definitely like for a week that was kind of defined by those new Tesla standard models, which were kind of really underwhelming.
The Temu Teslas.
The Temu Teslas.
Yeah.
This was a lot more exciting to me. What did you think about it?
Yeah, I was pumping my fist when I saw the specs and everything, like everybody else was. It's kind of cool how they made this car, honestly. And our guest Mark Royce is going to talk about this a little bit later. Like, it's not a completely new Bolt. Like, they took, you know, a lot of the old cars, like body and hard points, and just updated the hell out of everything else. So you've got modern batteries, charging software, like you said, Tesla NACS plug. And that's really interesting. Like I've never seen that heavy of an update within the parameters of the previous car, I think really ever in this industry. But that's what keeps this price down. And like the fact that it starts under 30 grand. And yes, that is including the fact that tax credits have been fired into the sun by the Trump administration. I think it's great, man. Like I there's been a real gap in the GM EV lineup. Like when they kill the Bolt, they're like, oh, the Equinox will do everything the Bolt did. And it's like, well, yeah, like the Equinox has been great and it's been selling quite well. But like there are people that really love that below 30K price and that small size, you know, super popular in fleets, popular in cities. And it's like, now it's back and better than ever.
Yeah. And especially now that now the tax credit's gone away, right? Like the Equinox, you know, starts in the mid 30s. When you had the tax credit, it was like high 20s. Now you have the Bolt that kind of takes the place of that. So it makes a lot of sense to release it right now.
It's a super bummer that like the Bolt now isn't going to start at like 22 grand with the tax credits, which would have been like, unhinged. Probably would have put Slate Truck out of business overnight, maybe. But no, it's there is kind of one downside, right? Because there's always a catch with these things. And like very cryptically, General Motors said like the Bolt is going to be limited run, or it's got like a limited production. And we don't know how limited it's going to be or how long they're going to make it. Like they already said they're only going to make it. They're going to make it on one fewer production line. It's made in Kansas. They're going to make it in one fewer production line than they thought. And they say, like, officially, we cannot disclose forecast volumes. We move quickly to retain the nameplate in our portfolio for a little longer after hearing feedback from ending production. So I don't know. It's very odd. Like, what do you make of that?
I don't know. I've never seen something like that from a car company before. I mean, for some backstory, which a lot of our listeners probably already know, is that the Bolt was, you know, kind of one of these OG EVs, super popular for many years. Then they just axed it pretty suddenly a few years ago.
And then 23.
What they say is, you know, because of the outpouring of support from Bolt owners and others, they brought it back. Which was probably a good move, given the affordability stuff. But yeah, limited run is really weird. To me, that means that I guess it's probably not going to stay around for like an entire generation. You know, I like maybe it won't be that 3 or 4 or 5 year timeline. Maybe it's only going to be around for another 2 years until they can bring out other affordable stuff. Or maybe they mean limited run in the sense that everything is limited run. You know,
everything is limited run. Maybe they mean it
in the existential sense. I don't know.
Yeah, man. We're all dying since the day we were born, Tim. You know, dust in the wind, man. Like, it's, you know, for all
exactly.
things must end.
Yeah. So,
someone who wrote that, like, the Bolt's press release is getting really, really existential. And I, you know, just sending good energy that person's way. Anyway, it's what's cool is that, like, that's one great affordable EV choice we have coming up, but not the only one, certainly.
Yeah. So between that and the new Nissan Leaf, which we've talked about before, it seems like kind of despite all the bad news and all the tariffs and the canceled products, we're also sort of entering this new era for affordable EVs, right? Even before things like the Slate and the Ford truck and whatever else is coming down the road are here. So the new Leaf costs just over $30,000 when you include fees, destination fees and that sort of thing. And just like the Bolt, it's this old EV that's kind of gotten a really big glow up to 303 miles of range now. That's up a lot from before. 150 kilowatt charging, Tesla style NACS port, and also a level 2 J1772 port on the other side, which is kind of cool.
It's got two charging ports, one Tesla and one like slow like charge point home plug or whatever, which is insane and kind of hilarious.
Yeah. And importantly, like, it's not a hatchback anymore. It's a you know, a little crossover. It's totally redesigned, unlike the Bolt. And you have been driving it. So what do you think of the new Leaf? I mean, nobody's driven the Bolt yet. We just kind of have seen the specs and we've seen what it looks like. What do you think of the Leaf and how do you think it'll compare to the Bolt?
I have to give the 26 Nissan Leaf back tomorrow, and I'm actually really sad about it because I actually freaking love this thing. I did not expect this at all, but it ended up becoming like one of my favorite new cars I've driven this year, like period. It just checks a ton of boxes. Like I think for a lot of people and even for me personally, it feels like the kind of EV that would have been like 50 grand a few years ago for like no discernible reason at all. Like, it drives great. It's front wheel drive, which I don't love on electric vehicles. It's a lot of torque going to the front wheels from electric motors, but it's almost like a little hot hatch. I like it because it's small. It's like not, it's taller, but it's not that much bigger than like my Mazda 3 gas car is, which I like the size of that. So it's great to park. Mm-hmm. It's nice inside. It has Android Automotive OS, which is, I think, becoming like probably the best way to do in-car software right now. It's better than any like Nissan tech I've really ever tested.
And Google built in. So it has the Google Maps in it, which is to me feels like kind of, you can't have a car that doesn't have that anymore. It's kind of great.
Yeah. Like I, you know, the Kia EV6 I have and like those Hyundai EVs are great, but like the decisions the map makes is baffling. I mean, it's just like my kingdom for Google Maps, and like this has it all built into this car. So it's a really cohesive package. It's just like it's got a lot of character. It's way more interesting than the Aria ever was. I was thinking the other day, like I like this better than like any Nissan I've maybe ever driven, besides the GTR, which kind of doesn't count. I was like, when was the last time I drove a Nissan and liked it? And the best answer I could come up with was like, well, I kind of liked the last Maxima, but I hated the transmission like everyone else, and that ruined the car. So, you know, really kind of nice to see this company come out of the gate with something that's this good. And last point I'll make is about that price, right? Because like the $30,000 thing is getting all the headlines. And that is the base price. Cloth seats, you know, very few options or anything. Like realistically, the Leaf you want is like 36 grand. But that's still really good. I mean, like for what you're getting and considering how expensive new cars are, like that's excellent. The one I'm driving right now is like press car, fully loaded, all the boxes checked. It's like 42. I don't think I'd recommend people go that high, but like it is a nicely equipped little car. And we might buy one next. Like my wife and I both were just like, yeah, this whenever that Kia leases up, like this might be the guy. So we'll see. I'm impressed, you know. It'd be nice. Interesting to see how that goes head to head with the Bolt though.
Yeah, for sure. They're close in a lot of ways, but also, I mean, the 300 miles of range, I think psychologically, a lot of people are going to say, you know what, the Bolt might be a couple grand cheaper, but 255 miles versus a little over 300, like, I kind of got to go for the Leaf. I think the other big one is CarPlay, right?
Yeah.
The new GM EVs don't have CarPlay. They don't have Android Auto. So if you get the Leaf, which, like we said, we haven't actually driven both, stacked them head to head, but you get the Leaf. You also get a cheap EV, but you get CarPlay and more range. To me, that maybe has a slight edge over the Bolt.
Yeah, and people will make that calculus. I know this because we get emails all of the time from people who are mad about not having CarPlay. Like that is a totally. I told GM this, like that is a real thing. Like it is a real purchase decision factor. So hell yeah, signs of life from Nissan. Like good for you guys, man.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that this $30,000-ish Nissan Leaf isn't actually the full base model, right? They're going to announce one that goes even lower than that, high 20s, probably range a little lower. So it may end up that like pound for pound, the Leaf is actually, the Leaf's probably going to be the cheapest EV you can buy in America, cheapest new EV you can buy in America come next year.
This is fun, man. This is like watching like these two old rivals like get in shape and throw down again, you know? Like it's like
this, I know it's hilarious rematch. That even in like in 2025 it still is about the Bolt versus the Leaf, which it was like 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, this is becoming like the Mustang versus Camaro of the electric age. I don't know if I fully stand by that, but it's fun to think about. But the reason these things are winning, it's just like the cars are too damn expensive, Tim. They're just damn expensive. It came out this week, some really like not amazing data about the American economy and people's like purchasing power. The average new car buyer paid almost $46,000 in September, according to J.D. Power. Other estimates that may or may not factor in things like incentives have put that number higher at like 50 grand. The point is like cars are more expensive than ever. And like just in the last 5 years, they have skyrocketed and more Americans are finding themselves upside down on their car loans now. Some new data from Edmunds says that in Q3 of this year, there's like a bigger share than ever of people trading in vehicles worth less than what they owe. And the debt that they're rolling forward into new car loans is only growing, which sounds great. Like
yeah,
that doesn't sound like a bad thing at all, you know?
No. Sounds great for our economy. The weird thing, and I don't know, probably some data person from one of these research firms will tell me that I'm doing the math wrong or that this doesn't quite make sense. But it's even worse when you look at the monthly payments and the loans that people are taking out because, you know, the transaction price is one thing, but almost nobody is buying their car in cash. They're all taking out long, long loans that are getting longer. And so if you look at the latest Edmunds numbers from the third quarter, average loan term is now 70.1 months. So what is that? Now I'm going to look like an idiot. Almost 6 years. Almost
making 6 years. Writers do math. It's something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Wait,
70 divided by 12. It's 5.8. Mike Perkins, our producer in my ear. Is like, are you kidding me? I was like, oh, like you knew that, like you know how to do division, Mike Perkins.
I think
Come on.
Said it right.
Don't lie.
But yeah, so 70 months.
Yeah.
The average monthly payment is $754 a month.
Jesus.
With a down payment of $6,000. Interest rates are higher than they've ever been, pretty much 7%. And so when you look at the math, people are actually paying over the course of that term, the average is about $59,000 that people are paying for a car over that 6 year loan term, which is just crazy. Like even when you look at the 46,000 or the 50,000 number that we see often, that does not tell the whole story. It's actually way more than that when you factor in the interest payments and stuff. It's nuts.
It's wild. CNBC had a really good story this week too about they call it like the K curve, and it's like if you're on the upper income level, you're going up like this. That's the first part of the K, and there's the everybody else is just you're going down, like your purchasing power, you're earning all that, and it's not even a curve, it's just a letter. But like I think that's a really fascinating way to think about how this is going. So the point is the cars are too damn expensive. People can't afford stuff, and if any company wants to win on EVs or anything else, I think it's got to deliver value more and more. Like people are just saying no to these like crazy high prices that marked the industry after the pandemic. So, you know,
for sure. Let's move on to one more bit of quick news before we talk to Mark Royce. We now know what America's first EREV will be, America's first extended range electric vehicle. And it's actually not any of the ones that we've talked about many times in the show. It is not the Ram truck and it is not the Scout.
Yeah. Well, first EREV SUV, the company we're about to talk about said they were the first, but we think the Chevy Volt and BMW i3 would like to have a word there.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, first modern EREV.
First modern, for sure. Yeah.
Of this era. So, now we know it is going to be the 2026 Jeep Grand Wagoneer. That will get the EREV treatment in the same way as the Ram truck, which is also from Stellantis. So some details about that 3.6 liter V6 that generates power that goes to a 92 kilowatt hour battery. This thing will have 647 horsepower, 620 pound feet of torque. Jeep says that this Grand Wagoneer will do 0-60 in 5 seconds, which is insane. And they say late availability for this model. So probably sometime mid next year is what we're betting on. And importantly, so the electric-only range has been reported at 150 miles. So it's roughly similar to what we knew about that Ram truck.
Yeah, so almost certainly same platform, same setup there. And just for those new to this world. This is a new thing. EREV is electric vehicle platform, electric vehicle battery. You add a gas engine and all it does is recharge that battery. It doesn't drive the wheels. That's what makes it different from a hybrid or plug-in hybrid. New thing. We're going to see if Americans catch on to it. I think the Jeep Grand Wagoneer EREV, or confusingly the REEV, because they call it range extended EV or REEV. Is it going
to
be different?
Yeah, they keep trying to make REEV happen.
Stop making REEV happen. Yeah, it's weird. When we hear from other car companies on the benefits of EREVs, I'm going to go with that over REEVs, they say it's beneficial because those can use smaller batteries than an EV and smaller engines. Like, I was on a roundtable with Hyundai CEO, and he was saying the same things. Like, you don't need as big a battery for this, and you don't need a huge engine either. And me and Kevin Williams, we were in China this year. We drove an EREV from Lincoln Co. It's a Geely Group brand that we really liked, and it had a 52 kilowatt hour battery and a four-cylinder engine. This guy from Jeep, this is America we're talking about, and in America you go big or you go home. 92 kilowatt hour battery and a big V6 engine, the Pentastar, baby. America's first EREV SUV is it's a big old beef boy packing lots of range.
Yeah. So what do you think about this? What do you think about Jeep, about Stellantis? Do you think they can nail this? Because, I guess I'll start with my thoughts is, like, I'm kind of afraid. I think EREVs are really cool. We've been talking, there's a reason we talk about them all the time. I think it's an interesting solution for this problem of EV range, especially in these big trucks. I'm kind of afraid Stellantis is going to screw it up for everybody and this won't work because, Stellantis has not proven that it can do EVs well at all, right? There's the Fiat 500e, which is like, fine, whatever. Nobody really buys it. The Jeep Wagoneer S, frankly, like, I forgot that. I constantly forget that it exists. It has not gotten shining reviews.
I saw one on the road like a month ago. I was stunned. My jaw was on the floor. Someone bought one of those things.
Yeah, the Dodge Charger, which you drove, the Charger Daytona is like a cool muscle car, but actually kind of a bad EV, like bad software, bad one pedal driving, bad charging performance. So the idea that they're going to come in with this like brand new, essentially brand new type of powertrain and like sell America on the EREV in a Jeep Grand Wagoneer is kind of like, okay, that sounds like harder than making an EV, doesn't it?
It does. And they've been bad at marketing these cars too. Like, they were really kind of ashamed at the fact that like the Charger EV was electric at all. And like, I'm wondering like, how do you build the benefits of this EREV? How do you get people to buy that over? Cause it's going to have conventional engines too. It's not EREV only, like it's going to have like a V8 and it's like, why are people going to buy this stuff? So I don't know. Every decision Stellantis makes, I'm just like, okay guys, like cool. Sure. Like, keeping Alfa Romeo and Maserati around or saying they're going to do anything at all with Chrysler or, $100,000 Ram trucks. It's just like, okay, like everything is baffling and nothing makes sense ever, but we'll.
But one thing that does make sense, and I found this hilarious in the, I don't know if you saw this in the press release from Jeep. So a few years ago, when they came out with these, with the Grand Wagoneer and the Wagoneer, these big luxury full-size SUVs, they were like, these aren't Jeeps. This is a new, it's our luxury brand, Wagoneer. And it didn't say Jeep on it, and it wasn't the Jeep Wagoneer. And now they've decided to walk that back. They say, in the press release, they say, the Jeep brand is taking a bold step to simplify and strengthen its SUV lineup by fully integrating the Grand Wagoneer under a unified flagship name. Do you want to guess what it is? The Jeep Grand Wagoneer.
Oh, yeah. This is why you and I do what I do, is like neither of us could like write that in a press release and like still look at ourselves in the mirror every morning. So I don't know.
Starting with the 2026 model year, every Grand Wagoneer will proudly wear the Jeep badge. It's like, we all knew it was a Jeep all along. Why'd you start? Yeah. Why'd you pretend it wasn't?
And it didn't work, and nobody bought them. No, like, it was like they positioned that as like this Escalade killer, and like, friend, like you got to get up real early in the morning if you're going to take down America's greatest vehicle, the Cadillac Escalade. So I don't know. It's this. I don't want to like pick on this company too much, but it's just got a lot to prove on every conceivable front, and I don't envy them being in that position.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, good on them for trying to introduce this cool new technology to America. Let's see if it works out.
Well, earlier this week, despite selling a record number of electric vehicles in the third quarter of this year, General Motors announced it's going to incur a $1.6 billion charge, the cost to retool its car factories to make fewer EVs and other things. It's anticipating much slower EV demand without the tax credits in place. But GM maintains the future is electric, even if getting there isn't always straightforward. Our next guest is here to explain what's coming and how GM is playing the long game. Well, today on the Plugged In podcast, I'm thrilled to say we are joined by someone who's held a lifetime of top executive positions at General Motors, has overseen the development of some of its most groundbreaking products, and is a racer and a gearhead in his own right. And he's got a lot to say today about what's next at GM. Please welcome General Motors President Mark Royce. Mark, thanks for being with us, sir.
Well, thank you, Patrick, and that's very nice. So I appreciate that. Great to be here with you and Tim. It's great.
Yeah, thanks so much. I think let's jump right into it with some news that we're very excited about that is, as we're recording this, dropping pretty much right now. The new Chevy Bolt has been announced, the new but also old Chevy Bolt. Tell us about that. You know, what's important about that new model? Why bring it back? And one thing that we've been thinking about is, you know, will this be profitable from the start for GM?
Yeah, a great set of questions there. Let's start with, you know, what it is, what the new one is here. And it's really, we had a great formula. And I don't know if you guys look at forums, but the Bolt forum was one of the very best, is one of the very best. So we paid a lot of attention in that forum to what people liked and what they wanted to improve on the car. So we had one of the most clear voices of customers, you know, that we could get input from as we refresh the car. So we did go out of production because we had a whole set of plant allocations and products across the company, and it was a chain. And so we knew this was, you know, going to go out of production for a little bit, and it did. Never fun, but that's why. When we brought it back, we wanted to, again, focus on what customers wanted. And, you know, a lot of it is charging speed. You know, we're going to get up to, there's capped at 50 kilowatts. We're at 150 on this one. So I think people will really be excited being able to go from, you know, 10 to 80% in about 26 minutes. That's pretty cool. So that'll be fun and very important for a lot of people. And then, you know, we're getting a 65 kilowatt LFP pack on it. So the cost is much less than what we were doing before, which, you know, those were, it's a long time ago that we've had the car for a while. So lots changed chemistry wise, technology wise, manufacturing wise, all that's changed. So that's good. And, you know, we've got another 10 miles of range from a 255, which is really important for our customers too. And then we've got a little more horsepower, like 10 more horsepower out of it. So that's, we use the front motor out of the Equinox. So we got to get a little more power, a little more range, a lot faster charging, and some really good things, I think, from a styling and design standpoint, particularly in the interior.
Yeah.
The form factor is the same. We know people, and I'm one of those people that driving the car, I've hit my head on the hatch because of the rear shape of that hatch.
I'm glad I'm not the only one there. That's good.
No, I've done it. I've done it. It's not fun. It's like, yeah, it's like hitting your head on a garage door as it's closing or something. I don't know. It's bad. So not great. But anyway, that's a really good improvement on it as well. And you know, I think the design is a nice refresh and a nice a really nice user interface change inside the car as well. So still have, you know, mechanical physical knobs, which is really important, mixed with the software. So I think people will enjoy that too. So I think it'll be a really fun thing for people to get back into.
This is an interesting car to me because it integrates so much new hardware and technology and batteries and software, but also retains, you know, a lot of the form factor and components from the original Bolt. Like it's not like 100% a clean sheet design, right? But it is a lot of new stuff. So like that's kind of unusual in the car world, it feels like. How was that a challenge for your engineers, or was it easier in some ways?
Well, we've been working on it for a little while. Even, you know, again, planned production stoppage and then restart and in tool shift gives you an opportunity to do some of that, Patrick, as you might know. So we took advantage of that and really listened to the people who love the car and have driven the car, but also we have a lot of competitors. You might see this. If you benchmark packages, and I'm talking about vehicle package, you know, in the front and rear and form factor and how efficient they are, the Bolt stands out. And we see mm-hmm. people trying to copy it because it's a smaller car to drive, but it feels like a really good, capable vehicle that holds both people and you know, it has some utility to it without being a big squared off SUV.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cool, right?
Yeah.
And it is benchmarked.
Yeah. And so you've also mentioned in the past a family of Bolts that will be coming. Mm-hmm. You know, to the extent you can, what should we expect from that? You know, is that smaller and cheaper than what we've seen today? Is it bigger, more expensive? Is it a completely different form factor that's not Bolt-like at all in the way that we'd expect?
That's a great question because it'll be what comes after this, whether it's called a Bolt or not, will be a family of things that is low priced. Hmm. And so that's good news for everybody. And, you know, when I say family, they won't be adopted. They'll be in the same vein of size and price. So, but I think it's another opportunity for us to look at, battery chemistry and form in a different architecture underneath that can be more efficient, even more efficient, and give people even more car for the money. But I also think that there's some white spaces in size, class of forms, not only the Bolt that we just introduced, but also some different things for different people's styled tastes. So
when you're talking about this family, like a price ranges, do you have anything in mind or can you say, or?
Well, this one, you know, is at $29,999, you know, so, which is probably the cheapest one out there right now.
Yeah.
I think, but it's around that price point. So plus or minus. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And so where do you think those white spaces are then in terms of the size and class?
Well, you're trying to ask me what the cars are going to be, and I can't talk.
Gotta try.
I know. I get it. I just can't, it's a competitive business. So I would love to talk about that all day, but I just can't give all that away.
In due time.
We get it. And we appreciate you giving us a lot there. We talk about a competitive business. That's a good segue to what I want to ask you. It's a bit more of a personal question, honestly. It's, you know, you and other GM executives have made clear that surviving, you know, electric mobility, it's a matter of survival for you guys. And, you know, you've had a storied career at GM. Your father was there for almost 40 years also. Like, I feel like for you, maybe more than almost anybody else in the American auto industry, like, does this feel like a personal challenge in some ways?
You know, I think, it's a great question. And most of my career has been spent as a personal challenge, to be quite honest. There's a lot of defiance in me to prove people wrong, especially when a company goes through what we went through a long time ago. Yeah. And people said, you know, you're not going to make it. You'll never be successful. Those are pretty strong. That's a pretty strong fire that burns inside of me personally, and has for a long, long time. So, you know, there's people that said we will never be a good electric car maker again. You know, there's a whole, you know, people that made careers off of doing that, showing up in movie theaters, doing all that stuff, right? So that was, that was just one example of that. There's also people that somehow I think my dad got me the job, which is always really interesting to me personally. So I started as a valve train engineer and a dynamometer in a lab. So
yeah,
he didn't give me that job, and he's certainly he's passed away. So I don't think he's doing that right now. Yeah. So
appreciate the candid answer there. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, so there's all sorts of those things around me that that I do hold very personally. And
yeah,
I don't always make the right calls. I don't always make, you know, I make mistakes just like everybody else. We're human beings. So you learn from the mistakes and you move on and try and do the best you can.
Yeah. So looking back, you know, you've been overseeing kind of various phases of GM's electric transition over the years. Looking back, if you knew what you knew now, you know, in hindsight, is there anything you would do differently?
Yeah. I feel like we're going to need a couple hours and maybe some beers that one.
Yeah. I mean, like, is there a category you might be interested in?
I'd say, how'd you answer that? And like, we want to get into, like, you guys have done a tremendous amount right lately. You've had a lot of victories too. But like, if you had perfect hindsight, just and what comes to mind and what you wish you knew now, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't around for EV1 quite yet. I wasn't in the company, but I think that would have been one example of something that we the company should not have done, which was canceling that. Mm-hmm. That was really quite a car. And so what do you do with that? I would say there's also things that I wish we didn't have to do, but we did, which, you know, stopping the Bolt, I wish we didn't have to do that. I wish we didn't have to stop the CT6 for Cadillac, but we did. And we converted factory zero, and we wouldn't have the trucks that are in that factory. So, you know, those are tough decisions. Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of those. And I think, you know, if I had perfect hindsight on tariffs, that would be really helpful.
Yeah.
If I had perfect hindsight on things like the pandemic, that would have been really helpful too. Mm-hmm. To get a head start on trying to get, you know, chip supply, the whole industry, you know, taking it out of anywhere but the United States was pretty tough. You know, that would have really been nice to have. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of those crises. Had we known that what was going to be handed to the industry and our company, we would have, that would have been very helpful, but you can't. So,
and it's been a decade in particular of curveballs, everything you just mentioned, right? Pandemic, chip shortage, tariffs now. And it's, I'm curious, in our current moment, you know, we're facing like a 180 degree policy difference on electrification in America than you used to. Like, so how do you navigate that as a business that has to plan long term and with such a big shift we're seeing now?
I think that's that's the current situation is that you outlined, Patrick, which is we're right in it right now. I think the strategy that we set a few years ago to grow our company with electric vehicles and ICE vehicles and being able to manufacture some of those in the same place like Spring Hill, Tennessee, and have cell plants in the United States located in the places we do. You can talk about adoption rate. You can talk about where we are today. But, you know, all I know is the adoption rate isn't as quick as what we thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
But it's still happening. And then what, you know, tax credit goes away, what's going to happen? We're going to see what happens. But I can tell you that a high percentage of people that buy an electric vehicle, for instance, buy another one.
Yeah.
So that's a really good flywheel to be on and a good trend that's long-term. And while the rate may fluctuate year to year in terms of how many, it's permanent and it's real. And I don't see it ever not being a big part of the U.S. auto industry. So we're here to do that. And policies aside, setting strategy around policy is, well, you see some other companies doing that. It's a very short-term, dangerous activity. You got to set what's right for the customer, for the country, and for the company that you're in. And I really believe that. And whipsawing things around, there's no, you know, we use enough capital in our industry as it is, but whipsawing strategy around policy is a really fast way to destroy capital.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting way to segue into that, right? Because if we're seeing a potential slowdown in EV sales across the industry in America, like, does that impact your ability to put R&D into like the next generation of EVs? Does that impact those decisions? I mean, like, I wonder, we've sort of wondered, like, does this cause American car companies like you guys or whatever to slow down, and one day perhaps BYD or another player shows up with their technology being far even more advanced than it is now? Like, how do you balance that?
I think we are very fortunate as a company to have an ICE and EV portfolio. And so our ICE portfolio, obviously, right now is very strong and will be strong. It's probably arguably the newest in the industry, I would say, most refreshed in probably the most segments as well. And that's fueling the reinvestment in R&D to win across both EV and ICE.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so one of the things that we talk about a lot is just how quickly this technology, this EV technology, has been improving and evolving, even in the short span of, you know, this kind of modern EV era over the last few years. You know, what sticks out to you as areas within GM where this technology is moving really quickly, you know, things that you're excited about, the direction that this is going?
Yeah, I'll talk about batteries, right? Kirk Kelty is a wonderful leader. We're fortunate to have him. But I would say we capacitized and facilitized our campus in Warren, our tech center, for total vertical integration of cell and pack and manufacturing of cell and pack. And so if you look at the coupon cells and now the cells that we can produce on site for promising chemistries that can actually be validated across the railroad tracks, that can actually be then developed from a manufacturing standpoint before we go into the big, large form packs and modules. And that chain is on the north end of our property. And, you know, yesterday we're talking about LFP, tomorrow we're talking about LMR. You know, this stuff, that LMR is a direct result of being able to do that on property. And so that's what excites me. It's very cool.
How much of a game changer is, I'm trying to remember the exact acronym here, and covering EVs makes me wish I had paid more attention to science class.
Lithium manganese rich.
Manganese rich. You Googled that. I know you Googled that. And cheated, but it's okay. But tell me what a big deal that is for General Motors in particular, and like your battery competitiveness across the world.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the struggle is always, you don't see any real battery electric midsize trucks, for instance. Right. And so
not yet.
So why is that? Well, if you think about it, the truck doesn't have enough packaging space to handle the battery packs needed for the duty cycle of the truck. And so do you sell a truck that's deficient on the duty cycle? Probably not in that segment. Probably not a great idea. Do you get something that has a better energy density at a lower cost, that you don't have to package as much battery into the truck to get the duty cycle? Now you're talking, right? And so when you think about LMR and some of those, it doesn't have the inherent negativeness of charge speed or ultimate capacity and energy density. Those are all trade-offs on these chemistries. And so I think when you start talking about that and the form factor that goes into it, you can take thousands of dollars out of those packs and offer people an incredible value with a duty cycle that's almost the same as a gasoline pickup truck.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because like, you guys make some of the most pound for pound capable, probably the most capable electric trucks that you could buy. I think we both agree, though, that like the big battery approach, like the 200 kilowatt hour approach, has multiple downsides. So is LMR the answer to that, or is it an answer to that? Or like, where do you see the electrified truck field going next?
Yeah, I think 2 years ago, everybody said you can't do LMR, right? This is, like you said, both you guys, Patrick and Tim, said it's changing so fast. So Is it a better solution today than what we're using today? Absolutely. Is it the answer? I don't think so. Not yet. I think there's more to go. Yeah.
Would you elaborate on like where you'd like to see that go, whether it's as a businessman or an engineer or both? Like what do you imagine is the future there?
Yeah, I mean we're you get into 9,000-pound trucks, right? With a dual stack 24 mod pack on a pouch cell, pouch lithium cell. It weighs a lot. Now it puts out a lot of power. So you can do an Escalade IQ will do, roughly 4 seconds 0-60 with that pack, which is pretty awesome for a 9,000 pound deal. But there's downsides to it. Like you said, anything that heavy is something that is much heavier than anything else on the road. There's all the as an engineer, mass wise, if I can get battery out of that truck and still get the duty cycle that we have in that truck and the capability, as you mentioned, on those trucks, that's a big win for the customer. Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about China a little bit. What do you make of the threat of these, high tech, lower cost to build Chinese vehicles, for one? And two, you're in a unique position as GM also doing business in China with the Chinese.
Profitability these days, profitability. Yeah, we've turned very that good. Around.
Yeah, yeah, with a Chinese, joint venture partner where you're building cars. So what are you also learning from them? What would you like to learn from those Chinese manufacturers?
Well, we got a few JV partners over there. One of them is SGMW. So it's mainly, if you look at what they sell, it's mainly architectures that are commercial type vehicles or smaller vehicles. And so we've had, been partners with them quite a long time. So we know the way the architecture functions. We know the way it's engineered. So it is a joint venture. So I'll leave it at that. But there's a ton to learn. There's also an interesting way they go to market. As their market always expands, or generally speaking expands, but it expands from the big cities to the cities that are probably in some cases less populated and a little more rural. And so but in the dense cities where there's a lot of people and a lot of cars, they have the approach of having the customer actually putting stuff in the car and seeing if customers like it. And so the infotainment is one of the things that I would speak of. There's also a trend towards voice only, instead of the combination of things we see here, and other places, which is really interesting and really awesome. I mean, their voice stuff works really well, so I'm very impressed by that. There's a lot of companies that come and go, a lot of brands that come and go, and they come and go often. Unless you're selling batteries, it's a pretty tough financial deal to make money doing it over there. And so the capacity expansion all over the world is a result of the capacity expansion in China. And so we don't have that here necessarily. We've got a pretty stable, 16, 16 and a half, maybe 17 million unit deal. Relatively stable amount of brands, although we've seen the EV brands come and grow. Which has been good competition for everybody here. But I would say, we can learn a lot from the speed. I don't think that copying each other on and pricing each other, trying to price each other out of the market, is necessarily a great thing.
Mm-hmm. It wouldn't work here.
It is. Yeah, it's not working.
So what do you? What do you think is behind that speed? You're talking speed of development, speed of going to market with new vehicles, with new features, even. Yeah.
I can tell you on the hardware side that they will all go to relatively the same or similar suppliers to source things like brakes, corners, control arms, in some cases, all the things technically that you would think are foundational, particularly in sedans or variants of sedans. They will source to the same source pool, and the cost will go down. And then they try and underprice and get volume to run the volume. That's pretty tough, right? But I think that's the speed of that is because there's a lot of similarity in how the car drives in terms of ride handling, vehicle dynamics, quietness. They benchmark the heck out of each other, and then they will copy it and then put it into production, and then the next person comes, does it, and they copy it. You know, so it goes on and on, and so it's a very, very rapid cycle because of that. So the sourcing times, the styling times, they're very different, and they're very fast because they're going to a pretty known set of suppliers.
Yeah. Are you planning for a day where General Motors might have to compete in America against one of those brands, even if they're made in the United States? I see nodding, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. And I think at the end of the day, the technology piece of that and investing in R&D, you mentioned it before, but I think the R&D technology investment in our company in this country is the way to compete. We can't go copy the way they do things, okay, and expect to win. Won't happen. So we have to be better, and we have to be more advanced, and we have to spend on places that yield that technology and advancement to be able to win.
Very exciting. We're coming up on time, and I want to be respectful of yours, Mark. This has been such a great chat. Lastly, something fun and American, electric Corvette. What's the current status of that? What are you thinking there? And I'm not 100% sold on the idea myself either, even as an EV guy and someone learned to drive stick on my dad's C5 Z06. So
there you go.
Is it viable? Can it be done? Should it be done? What do you think?
I think it can be done. We've shown a slew of concept cars that are electric based. I wouldn't say the propulsion system is something that was true to form on those concept cars, but very interesting and allowed us to do a lot of different things, which electric vehicles do on form and design and you know, the aesthetic piece.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the status of the electrified Corvette is the 01X that I'm driving right now. And that's pretty awesome. And that's using electricity to do the right things that with a Corvette. All-wheel drive, 1,200 plus horsepower, using it for power, using it for speed, using it for ride and handling, using it for traction is great, great use of electricity on a Corvette. An all-electric Corvette, to make the Corvette do what a Corvette's supposed to do, is not something that's easy right now. Mm-hmm. And what I'm talking about again is when you get into mass from a vehicle dynamic standpoint, when you get into thermal performance, you can make advances in those, which we have. But I'm not sure the character of the Corvette and our buyer of the Corvette is ready to be the recipient of that effort quite yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree with all that. But there would possibly, if a day comes with technology changes, lightness, things like that are more achievable, then it seems like it could it be more in line with those values potentially?
I agree. Could be. Yeah, absolutely. But not yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not yet. Never say never. That's why we got to keep investing in technology and R&D. Yeah.
Well said.
All right. Mark Royce, thanks so much for being on the show today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Patrick.
Thanks so much, Mark. Tim.
It was a pleasure. Always a pleasure being with you guys, and I really appreciate it. Nice to meet you.
That was a great chat. Thanks for joining us, Mark. All right, now it's time for Plus Minus, our segment where we talk about who's up and who's down in the EV world this week. Tim, who you got for me?
I have a minus, and it is the Cybertruck, which I feel like has been a loser maybe before on this show, and generally in life, it has been kind of a loser for the last couple of years. You know, some of this sales data has come out for Q3 from Cox Automotive, and according to that, Tesla only sold a little under 5,400 Cybertrucks in the third quarter, down 63% compared to the same period last year when it delivered 14,000 Cybertrucks, which, you know, kind of when you compare it to other EV trucks, it's not that bad, but when you compare it to what Elon Musk said they were going to do, which was 250,000 Cybertrucks a year, this is not very good at all. The company has sold a little more than 16,000 Cybertrucks so far in 2025. So it's probably on track to do like 20,000 Cybertrucks this year, which is not 250,000. So Cybertruck not having a great time.
Not having a great time. And I, you know, I feel bad about being that negative, but also it's just like, I think everybody that wanted a Cybertruck like bought one. And then I just remember like in the long, long lead up to when that thing like went to production, there were like the hardcore Tesla stands, the TSLA, like super deep people who were like, this thing is going to displace the Ford F-150. Like this is the end of the other car companies. It's all Cybertruck and nothing else from now on. And like things really didn't work out that way, you might say.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, I can balance it out with something good. Like I actually think if the Cybertruck, without the whole Tesla stink and the Elon Musk controversy of the last couple of years of him buying Twitter and then him, you know, getting Trump elected and just kind of like the negativity around this brand, I think the Cybertruck could be absolutely iconic. I think it still might be. In the long run of time, 20, 30 years from now, you're telling me that people aren't going to like buy these things because they look insane and kind of prize them for that, you know, for just being like a kind of legendary piece of automotive history. I think that might happen. I also think if Tesla was still the Tesla of like 5-7 years ago, when Tesla was like really cool and Elon Musk was super magnetic and interesting, I think they could be selling a lot more of these things. I think they could be converting a lot more people who instead now are like, you know, they're just like not that jazzed about Tesla. They're buying Rivians, they're buying Escalades, whatever else it is. So
they bought a lot of Lightnings. A lot of Lightnings last quarter. Interesting. Like that was like way up year over year.
10,000 Lightnings sold last quarter. So you know, the EV truck market like has not been doing, I think, as well as anybody thought it was going to. But I also think the Cybertruck could have been a much bigger deal than it has ended up being.
No, I always thought that thing would be like decades from now. It's like on some mega hit on like Bring a Trailer, you know, which in the future we will all access on some sort of like Chinese AI metaverse VR goggle app that will be horrible. I'll end us on a positive note. My plus this week is actually the Porsche Cayenne Electric, which I'm pretty excited about. I think this thing, the more I hear about the Cayenne being like this really high tech EV that goes even beyond like what the Taycan does, the more I'm excited about it. Matt Hogan, our deputy editor, he went out and did a range test in this thing and managed about 353 miles, which for the size it is and the performance you get, quite good. It also does 400 kilowatt DC fast charging. So it's going to be one of the fastest charging cars you can buy in America when it goes on sale. So that thing is shaping up to be pretty cool. I hope that hope the Cayenne faithful like are into it, because I think it seems like it's going to do some interesting things there.
Yeah, and wireless charging, which I think is super awesome.
Which is awesome. Yeah, I'm excited to see where they go with that too. I don't know. People were kind of like crapping on wireless charging. I think it's interesting. I'm excited to see what happens with that. All right, well, thanks for listening to the Plugged In podcast from Inside EVs. We'll be back next Friday. Today's show was produced by Michael Perkins and brought to you by the Motorsport Network.
Make sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe to the Inside EVs YouTube channel, and check out all our latest coverage on InsideEVs.com. See you next time.
See you next time.